Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. This is your host, Andrew Keel. And today we have Glenn Yaney of Vertical Equity Partners on the show. Glenn Yaney started his real estate career in 2012 as a Tampa Bay, Florida property manager. Soon after, in 2013, he went on to become the leasing manager at American Homes for Rent, which is the single family, build-to-rent institutional owner. In 2020, he started Vertical Equity Partners, and they've grown to currently oversee 400 units, ranging from mobile home parks to apartment complexes, of which they manage all in-house. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Would you mind starting out by telling us a little about your story and how you got into investing in mobile home parks?
Yeah. So I think, not to make it too long, but I would say in 2010, I bought a Honda Civic and and I started learning about finance then. I had a 23.9 interest rate. And
wow,
at that time, it was the highest legal interest rate you could pay. And I quickly learned that $400 a month, $350 was going towards interest and $50 was going to principal. And that's when I started my financial journey to learning about interest rates and what not to do in the future. But what I can tell you is that whenever I got a little bit further in, I had a job at Red Lobster. I worked there for 7 years and eventually started reading books like Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and started getting into the financial. I was told to read more financial information and I ended up getting my real estate license, and I was working at Red Lobster and I was working for a small property management company. And at that time, I would try to get like a first-time home buyer to go find a house. And it was 2012. And I would show up to the house and the house would already be under contract at that time. And we found that there was a lot of institutional buyers at that time cleaning up, the wreckage of 2008. And the perfect house to buy would be like $150,000 to $200,000 house. And these buyers were ready to buy, but they were working with financing, and obviously you have an institution that's paying cash. So what I started doing is I started pivoting to make money in real estate is I started showing rental houses. And what I found was that this one company was paying about $1,000 commission for every time you would lease a house. And when I worked at Red Lobster, my highest, my average pay would be about $1,500 a month. And when I started finding these listings that were paying $1,000 per listing, I ended up making $15,000 in 1 month. And that was the beginning of me. I did that for about 2 months. And I decided that if there was a time to leave my serving job, it was then. And the company American Homes for Rent ended up recruiting me. That was the beginning of getting into the institutional property management. Through all of that, I started finding mentors, which were very helpful. I had one friend that had about 2,000 units in apartments, and I would call him to complain about the things that were going on at work, why we aren't leasing units and why they won't lower prices. He was an asset manager of 2,000 units, and he would say, well, maybe they're just trying to discover the rents. They don't know what the rents are really, because single family homes have always been, mom and pop. So it's like, you don't really know what single family home rents are until you let them sit out there long enough to see what they'll pay, because there's so much inventory. And so small things like that. And then I would go back to work and then I would mimic what he just said to me, to my bosses, and then started moving up the ranks and, worked there for 9 years. And right at the very tail end, COVID happened, and we ended up consolidating management. And I actually was able to be, leasing manager of Florida, where we had about 13, leasing agents, and I was in charge of, managing it. It kind of turned into a call center job. And through that, I kind of learned how to build systems. And it really just taught me how to manage like a call center, which it was a grind for sure, sitting at my computer the whole time. But
Let me jump in here real quick if I could, because this is an amazing story. So American Homes for Rent, I see their trucks all over town. I live in Orlando.
Oh, yeah.
They're all over the place, right? And and I'm not sure how many, right? But how many single family homes approximately do they own?
So in Florida, it's about 9,000. When I left, it might be more or less, but 9,000 in Florida, about 55,000 in the state, in the country.
9,000 in Florida, 55,000 in the US.
Yes.
Wow. So I have pretty strong feelings on this. I actually think that institutional capital owning that many housing units is not a good thing, right? Like, and who owns American Homes for Rent? Is that Blackstone?
Well, it started with the founder of Public Storage, the second biggest self-storage REIT in the, and I think it's a, I think it is the biggest REIT, self-storage REIT in the country, in the world. But he started with just buying 100 houses out in Vegas and built out a team, and they just went to town. But then they went public.
Wow, just absolutely amazing. I mean, what are some of the things you learned there? Obviously, as a leasing manager, you know, you're seeing tremendous demand, right, for the homes you have available. What about like the management side of things, the property management side of things? Did you learn anything from them, you know, managing at scale that now you use in your business today, you know, managing the mobile home communities and your apartment complex?
Yeah, so they were very good at scaling. It was almost like multifamily is still a lot of multifamily management, even at the 2000 to 5000 is still somewhat mom and pop, but this was like a very institutional structure. And what they would do is they would have streamlined for every single job there was. So for, instead of having like a property manager wear all the hats, this was, they had a leasing department, they had a maintenance department, they had a property manager, and then they had a call center that had all the inbound calls come in, and then they would field them through. So it was a
pretty big, yeah, big operation, as you can imagine, with 55,000 units. That's crazy. So how did you get to mobile home parks? Like, how do you go from that corporate America gig, private equity, you know, managing, leasing manager of Florida, which is, oh my goodness, 9,000 units. How do you go from that to mobile home parks? Like, what, how'd you hear about them?
So just real quick, back to the leasing manager of Florida, just the craziness of the scale or the volume that we were dealing with is we would lease 300 to 350 houses a month, which is the size of a normal apartment complex every month, which is kind of like wild to think about. And so anyways, but before that, I actually, I had a lot more interaction with the customers, and I came across one customer that had some mobile home parks, and he had a bank statement that showed that he was pulling in $60,000 a month. And I was, my mind was blown. Like it was very rare to see anybody over 20,000. And then I saw this one guy come in. He didn't look somebody that he didn't look the part that would, you would think somebody making 60,000. I thought that was unheard of, or it was unheard of. So I started asking him, and he sent me he showed me his bank statements to get approved. And there was all these small transactions going into his bank account, and I couldn't figure it out. And then I just finally asked him, I said, What do you do? And he's like, oh, I manage mobile home parks. And I literally thought to myself, is this guy living on site? Like, what's happening here? I couldn't put two and two together. But so anyways, I kept it pretty professional. I didn't go too far into it, but I did follow up with him after the fact to talk to him about mobile home parks and how he got there. And
he was renting a house. He was interested in renting a house from American Homes for Rent.
There's more to the story, but it was for, I guess we'll call it a significant other. And he was rented a house. Yeah. So he ended up,
divorced, I guess, probably.
He actually didn't qualify. It was funny. He didn't qualify. So it was a little weird, but It was one of those things where I'm like, hey, you're not qualified, but we could be friends.
Yeah.
So anyways, I ended up following him around. He was like literally on the ramp up of his career. Whenever I think he went from like being like, you know, as to come up, you're putting all your money into all of your real estate. You don't have any money. And I think it was just getting to the point for him where he started taking off with his portfolio. And I pretty much would, on my days off were like kind of weird. So I'd have like days off during the week, and I would take my days in the middle of the week to meet with this guy. And I would ride around with him to his mobile home parks. And
this was where at? Is this in Tampa? Like around Tampa?
Plant City, yeah. Plant City.
Wow.
And the thing he has that a lot of guys don't is that he actually has almost all of them in one area, like Plant City and Gibsonton and Tampa Metro, but really not far out. We call it the Plant City Metro. It's not even much further than that. He didn't have anything too much. Everything was 30-minute drive. And
what kind of parks are these? Like what quality, like what do they look like?
They're family parks. We'll call them C class or C-. Overall, they were
his model. Affordable housing.
Affordable housing. Yep. Mm-hmm. He didn't do any park owned homes. He just did lot rents, and he would just drive around, and we would look at a lot of construction. You know, a lot of these were people were moving out, and he was just renovating them, and had crews that were doing it at the time, and I would just follow them. Yeah, that was how I got into it. He ended up having his two first parks that he ever bought was a 3-unit and a 9-unit mobile home park. And they just happened to be a block away from each other. And he sold me the 3-unit first, seller financed. And then I think I put 10% down, seller financed. And then he gave me another one, seller financed. And that one was, I think, $350,000. So I ended up putting $25,000 down for that one, which is kind of unheard of to put have minimal down, but he was kind of helping me out and gave me, you know, pretty good.
What a crazy story though, right? Like somehow this guy was applying for a rental unit from American Homes for Rent, and somehow weirdly didn't qualify. It wasn't for him, it was for a significant other. Didn't qualify, you became friends, and he helped you get into the business. Like literally to the extent where he's selling you his parks, some of his mobile home parks.
Yeah.
Wow.
And really it was the launching pad that helped me become financially independent, those two parks. I mean, I had some real estate, I had some condos, and then I sold those, traded up to a little bit like a townhome, and I bought a couple single family homes. But the cash flows were just not equivalent to, you know, these 12 units that I bought.
So tell us about your portfolio. So those are pretty small parks. You know, you have 400 units. So you've grown, you know, beyond that. Are they all around Tampa? You know, are they a lot of small parks? You have some bigger ones. You know, what does your portfolio look like?
Yeah. So all of our portfolio is in the Tampa MSA. We have, they're all within an hour drive of each other. Our largest park is about 50 units. I think it's 46 units. And then they range from, besides my parks, it would be 10 units and up. And generally we buy them in pretty distressed, a lot of value add, and just convert them to make them, you know, a nice place to live for people. And we previously were in the park own model where we actually own the mobile homes, and we're starting to transition to just stick to the tenant owned.
Gotcha. So you have a lot of park owned home units. And like, did you do anything else to get educated, like on utility infrastructure, anything like that? Like, did you go to the Frank and Dave boot camp, or did you only just, you know, be a mentee under this mentor of yours?
Yeah. So Desmond was a mentor, and I have a friend, the same friend that had 2,000 units is now up. He's got 10,000 units. And he connected us with his attorney and showed us pretty much how to raise money. And we started with the first syndication was a 25-unit apartment building. And then once I bought this 3-unit and the 9-unit, my business partner, Garrett, we saw how lucrative it was to own mobile home parks and how expensive it really was to own apartments to an extent, you know. At the time, it was like the apartment prices were cheap, and then they were becoming no longer there. You know, it became over 100,000 a unit, and compared to our business model for mobile home parks is just to buy them around 30,000 a unit. That was our business model. We thought if we bought them for 30,000, that they would be, it was cheaper than the land we're buying it on, you know? So if you were to buy a vacant piece of land, it would probably be cheaper than the land we were buying. And we were getting, you know, it had all the infrastructure there to put mobile, you know, that had mobile homes on it. So we just thought it's hard to, it felt like it would be hard to mess this up.
So like, did you know anything about utility infrastructure? Are these all public utilities, the properties that you own? Is there some private?
Yeah. So almost every park we have is a septic tank park. A lot of wells.
A lot of well and septic. And how have those fared? You know, have you had any big learning experiences?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I didn't know what a leach field was when I started. And we bought this one park. We went to the health department and asked them about really if there's any violations, and there was like, no, there's no violations. And then like the day after we closed on the place, they're like, yeah, there's actually this septic tank actually needs to be fixed or replaced, blah, blah, blah. And then we found out that it was a, you know, just a $40,000 septic tank, you know,
oh my goodness.
Yeah. So that one we learned on that one, really those large septic tanks, you know, it was a big headache, but it was something we learned on. We found a good septic tank company, really, and we started getting connections through learning, really.
That's cool. Okay, so that tells us, you know, a little bit about kind of your portfolio and your background and kind of how you got started in the business. You know, where you're at now, and I have a lot of questions I want to ask. So we'll do like a lightning round. We'll do like quick answers, all right? So what do you think is like the toughest hurdle, you know, that you've had to overcome in mobile home park investing?
I really believe, I think it might be the hurdle that I'm dealing with right now is insurance. It's kind of like through doing these podcasts and listening to other people, you quickly, at first you're like, well, why would you get rid of a park-owned home when the rent is $1,200 and you're getting about $500 to $600 in rent? And through going through some refinancing, and the conventional financing is pretty tough on the park-owned homes, especially in Florida. You know, they require wind mitigation. And after Hurricane Ian, it's been pretty much non-existent for mobile homes to the age of mobile homes that we have. So yeah, it's constantly learning. It's, you know, through doing it, I wouldn't make the same mistakes we made with like maybe the septic tank the first time, which is a big expense. The things that we're fixing now is just how we operate the parks. And you learn, I mean, through guys like you, you wonder, it's like, why aren't they doing park-owned homes? And then you learn, it's like, well, they've been there too. It's hard to chase. It's hard to think about, like you're losing $1,300 in revenue, but you're lowering your revenue to actually become more profitable. It's the opposite of what everything I've ever been thought about real estate. You always thought you should always be increasing revenue. It's actually, you got to lower the revenue, but you actually increase it through decreasing the expenses is what happens. So
yeah, park-owned homes are definitely, you know, a niche. You know, some people can do it and do it well, you know, especially with like newer vintage, you know, the 90s and 2000s homes. If you can rent those for $1,200 a month plus, you know, there's some good cash flow there, but still they're going to come with the insurance, the taxes. Yeah. Just the additional expenses, interest rates. Yeah. You're going to have on the chattel loan for sure.
Yep.
Well, that's good to know. And when did you buy your first park? When was the 3-unit and the 9-unit? When was that? What year?
2020.
2020 COVID year. It's 2024 now. So, you know, it's only been 4 years and you've, you know, grown up to 400 units. That's pretty fast.
Yeah. It's,
what would you credit that to?
Well, I would say that we're in a great market and we have a great private money lenders, which helps a lot.
Totally.
We do mainly on the front end because we're doing heavy value add is through private lending. So through doing that, you have credibility. My business partner, Garrett, I kind of piggybacked off of his experience when I started. So whenever he had been doing this since 2009, and then he's a great deal guy, and my background is more of a property management. So that's kind of whenever I tagged in to help him with that operation.
Nice. What other mistakes have you made that, you know, other mobile home park operators or investors can learn from outside of the septic tanks? I mean, we definitely want to check out the leach fields and the septic tanks and avoid park owned homes. But what else, what other stuff, you know, in the last 4 years have popped up?
What I would say is just that these are all lessons that it would have been hard to learn without not doing the work. I can't think of much really.
No worries. That's good. And how are you sourcing these, Glenn? Like, how are these, you know, just mom and pops? Are these mostly through, you know, that, you know, Desmond, your mentor, or how else are you kind of getting these?
Well, we've pretty much gone through brokers. A lot of them are, because of the type of deals that we buy, they're smaller unit counts. They're harder to, it's more work to sell for a broker. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the bigger names or the brokers that are doing the larger listings aren't going to want to mess with a smaller park. So we find those brokers and we reach out to them, let them know, hey, look, this is what we're buying. And we're able to close with the private money. So you don't have to worry about the banks, and it makes us more marketable to them.
Gotcha. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That's because most people would say, oh, you got to go off market. But, you know, if you're going for smaller, you know, older vintage home communities that maybe, you know, they don't look the best, but they cash flow, you know, you're in a great market. I'm sure, you know, those are easy pickings. You can find them online, you know, for, you know, 10 plus cap rates, I'd assume, right?
Yeah. So with the adding to that, I think that sometimes if you're, it's always like the advertised thing to go cold call your own deals and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I think that a lot of brokers do favor people that rely on them, you know, and what I mean by that is that, so we've talked to other brokers and we kind of, you know, you just go to lunch with them and talk to them and they say, you know, they might find a deal for somebody and then that person's like, oh, I've already talked to that person. So then they kind of cut the broker out. You're like, well, this person, the brokers are pounding the phone all day long. And it's like something that is, even if they don't like do a lot during the transaction, they've done all the work up to the transaction, you know? So it's when they give us a lead, we respect it. And yeah, there's times that we don't hear from the broker until after we close, but at the same time, we would pay them every time just because they are, they're sending them to us off market. And,
that's awesome. Yeah. Building that relationship is key for sure.
It's by far the best deals we've had, you know, the ones it's hard to find them off market. It's like everybody, mm-hmm. there's so many cold callers out there that it's the brokers.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I got a team of five of them.
I always ask them who they're with. I always like, oh, what company are you with?
And say Keel Team. They'll never say that because I don't really want people to know they're with Keel Team. So we have like an alias company that they call from. But if they have like a foreign accent,
yeah,
it might be one of mine.
It could be. Yeah.
Yes. Glenn, what does the perfect mobile home park look like in your eyes and why?
I like the ones that are really rough. When we go in, I like them when they're, I'm like,
everybody else stays away from those.
Yeah.
But Glenn loves them.
Yeah. I think I welcome them with open arms. I really believe that's where the value is. I think, kind of like when we had the conversation a couple of days ago, mm-hmm. you said, something that struck a nerve with me. And I asked you at 3,000 units or pads that you're at, it's like, at what point do you stop or what do you do? And you said, I genuinely like the mission that we're on. And I really do believe that I'm in the same boat as that. I think to myself that these are either properties that are going to get scraped and redeveloped, or we can halfway redevelop the place to make it affordable housing for people that normally wouldn't be able to find housing, are able to find housing through what we're accommodating with, you know, and if we make it a safe environment as well. Cause sometimes you go in them, you're like, I don't know if this is where I should be, but if you do the proper background checks and make sure that you treat it as if you know that you and all the people that work with you are going to be walking through that park. You want it to be a nice place to live. And I would, you know, I just want it to be, you know, go to bed at night knowing that I've done the right thing. So
we just did a study that went all the way through last year because we were trying to identify our turnover and, you know, what the avatar tenant looks like that's turning over, right? That gets into a home and then decides to leave eventually. What we found out is like, only 25% of the tenants that turned over were people that we put in the homes. The majority of the tenants that are turning over, that are like leaving the homes, are legacy tenants that, you know, were with the old owner and, you know, they don't want to follow our new rules. They, you know, yes, the lot rent has gone up, but modestly, but, you know, they think that that's the end of the world. And, you know, I think some people, like, the bad eggs just kind of get filtered out over time. And that's really speaks to the asset class of like, hey, like the stickiness of the tenant that stays a long term. You know, I think good management, you know, can promote that, where these legacy, you're buying from mom and pops that own one park and maybe they started to get, you know, lazy with managing it later into their, you know, their retirement years, and it shows. And then that's where these, you know, these bad eggs kind of slip in. But I applaud you for that. Like, it's about the mission, right? Like, it's like, hey, we're out here providing affordable housing to people that desperately need it. And in Tampa, in the Tampa MSA, I mean, I've been over there. It's packed. I mean, it's what a great place to live. You're so close to the Gulf. It's awesome. But definitely you need a place for service workers and affordable housing for sure. So that's huge. Let me ask you this, Glenn. I ask this to every guest. If you were going to invest passively, as an LP or like a private money lender, if you were going to invest passively into a mobile home park deal, what would be like the major things, knowing what you know now, that you would want to know about the deal or the sponsor, you know, before investing?
So I heard this question earlier today. I listened to your podcast and I thought that's a tough question because I'm more of the active guy. But what I would say is that there's two ways to invest, and I think one would be debt and one would be equity, depending on the operator. I think that there are certain qualifications that would be helpful. So the debt, kind of, if you put that in place, it's kind of a consistency and it's more of a direct, you know, if it depends on
potentially
your position. Yeah,
potentially consistent, you know, right?
Yes.
But that's like you're saying, like they'd be the bank. They'd have a first position mortgage as their collateral for the loan. That type of private money. Okay. Debt.
And then you have to have I would say that I would focus more on the operator than the deal itself, just because if it doesn't matter how good the deal is, if the operator is, you know, just not, you know, doing their, you know, fiduciary duty. So it's, I like to hear the good and the bad. So if somebody tells me that there's everything good that's happening and nothing bad, it kind of makes me think that there's probably a lot going on. So I like to hear a little bit of the rough spots, and I'm kind of that way. I'll tell you that there's struggles. And what I would say is what we've done to overcome those, and obviously to try to put backstops in those places to not do that again. So.
Yeah. There's always hair on the deal. Right? Yeah. I've never seen a deal that was like 100% clean. So I think that's a good question as an LP to ask an operator, is like, hey, what's the hair on this thing? Like, bring it up to the top. I don't want to sift through your 40-page offering, you know, slide deck. Tell me what's the hair on the deal right away, right? I think that would just save a lot of time. And then you can decide, right? Because like I have a sticky note on my monitor right here. And it says, what does the deal hinge on? What's the biggest risk? Identify this first. And then it has, you know, that was a Sam Zell. That was one of his big things. And I think you could save yourself a lot of time, you know, underwriting and doing all this, you know, all this stuff behind a computer screen, researching and doing due diligence. If you just think about, hey, what's the deal hinge on? Is the market small? Are the homes in older vintage? Is there a lot of park-owned homes? You know, do you have to increase rents $100 the first year to make the numbers work? Like, you're going to know that with just doing the quick value, you know, underwriting. So just identifying that first, I think, is huge. So that's a good point. Yeah. What's the hair on the deal? Let's identify that first. So Glenn, obviously the economy is in a weird place right now. Interest rates are, you know, fairly high compared to the mean. You know, what do you think the future holds, and how do you think MHPs can, you know, fit in with that?
I think there's still an adjustment to mobile home parks, as in not price-wise, but with rents going up the way they have, I don't think that those are coming down. Like everybody, if you read the headlines, they say rents are going down. I don't see rents going down. And what I would say with mobile homes are obviously the as everyone that probably listens to this would agree, is just that it's the you know, it is affordable housing. Whether the government allows it is never, you know, that probably may never happen. But at the same time, to like overproduce mobile home parks, which will never happen. But I think with the interest rates, I believe that mobile homes will be able to weather it pretty well, especially with these rents. I don't think they've adjusted completely. I think there's still a lot of room for them to go up, and it's hard to grasp really you know, the affordable crisis we're in right now. So
yeah, there's a lot of demand. We listed one of our brand new homes the other day in Michigan, and we had like over 25 people the first day reach out. You know, it's just amazing, right? The demand is there. But then when you vet 25 people and you look through all the applications, you know, you find that there's a lot of people with bad credit history. There's a lot of people that, you know, don't have, you know, I would say consistent, you know, income, right? Like they've kind of bounced around the last few years with COVID and things like that. So it's an interesting time to be a landlord and, you know, to try to sift through that many tenants and find the right fit, you know, is definitely a big undertaking. What do you think is the biggest threat to mobile home park investing, Glenn?
Government. I would say that if there's somebody to throw a wrench in it, there's government. We have this one park where we had one resident we were evicting. He was squatting, and his mom was the old park manager, and he ended up calling code on us, building department. And it was for nothing that we did. It was what we inherited. And he just started pointing out all the problems. And now, you know, they want a permit for everything. And it's a very expensive way to handle, to get it completed. And, you know, so that's a lesson. And that, and buying smaller parks, these permits are a big percentage of the CapEx budget, is what I would say. When you have to go in and you have to get a general contractor in there for a park that you paid $750,000 for, it gets to be real expensive real quick. So,
yeah. And another thing, since you own all of your parks in Florida, that some of our listeners might not be aware of, is a prospectus is required in the state of Florida for mobile home parks that have 26 or more lots.
Yep.
And it basically will, you know, provides protections for the tenants and may include like rules and regulations of the park. And it's like required to be provided to a tenant before they sign their lease. And some prospectus will have like limitations on the rent increases and what you're going to get from that. And if you have a laundry facility on site and it's in the prospectus, you can't like come in and shut down the laundry facility. So maybe you can tell us about your experience with this prospectus and, you know, what you've run into.
So because we have majority park-owned homes, you do not need a prospectus. It's when you have it. We actually, because we're literally changing our structure. We're turning all these park-owned homes into tenant-owned homes, and talked to an attorney, really the process of doing that. And he said, well, once you get over 25 tenant-owned homes, you have to have a prospectus. But if you have, if it's all park-owned, it's actually the eviction process and everything and is managed as if it were an apartment. So yeah, that's kind of the difference. We would have to create a prospectus. Our attorney, we got on the phone with him yesterday, and he was going through the, you know, each park that we were thinking about converting, and there weren't any prospectus because they'd been park owned forever. And so anyways, I guess the law started in 1984. So it, I guess before that it could have been different, but since 1984, they've never had over 25 units that were tenant owned. So yeah, we're just learning about that. He gave us a long question, Q&A to fill out, and we have not experienced anything really against it. But I can tell you that one rule that they said on the prospectus, I don't know if it's just in Florida, but I have a friend, my mentor, he's actually dealing with it, but he, if your resident, it's the person you sell the mobile home to, has to receive a prospectus. But if the person that sells, if say I own the mobile home, I'm not the landlord, I'm just a mobile home owner, and I sell it to somebody, the prospectus is not required to be given to that new resident, is what we found out. My attorney told me, because they're in the middle of like an eviction, they're challenging it, but the person that's being evicted was sold the home by a tenant, and they didn't have to receive a prospectus. It's a short story. So
that's interesting. Yeah, because when I was doing the Lonnie dealing around Florida here, I kind of ran into this, because it was an interesting scenario, because I was buying just the homes and like talking to the different park owners, and through that, you know, since I wasn't living in the homes, you know, I was an investor, you know, we had to figure out a workaround around all of that. But yeah, definitely, you know, Glenn and I are not attorneys, disclosure here, you know, definitely check, you know, before you do anything to make a decision on, you know, who to provide a prospectus to or not. Definitely check with a Florida attorney, because that's pretty important. But Glenn, we're running short on time here. How can listeners get a hold of you if they'd like to do so?
So I do have a podcast. It's the Millionaire Journey podcast. And I also am on LinkedIn. My name is Glenn Yaney, and Twitter, I think it's also Glenn Yaney. So feel free to reach out to me there. I'd be glad to talk.
Awesome. Awesome. And what's one last bit of important advice you would give an interested passive mobile home park investor before we sign off?
I would say that that is a good question. I would say just I would focus on the tenant-owned home operators is what I would say. I'm learning that lesson now. So
that's good to know. That's good to know. Yeah, tenant-owned homes. You know, there's different models in mobile home park investing. Tenant-owned homes, you know, there should be some joint equity there, right, with the tenants and a pride of ownership.
Yep.
And that's what we've seen in our parks. And it for us, it's just been the reliability of that income stream, right? It's a stickier tenant that stays longer when they own their home, and they're, you know, they're vested, right? They own their home, where the park owned homes, you know, it's kind of like the apartments. And I had a small apartment complex in Daytona Beach. That was like one of my first investment properties that I got seller financed to me. And it was a, if there is such a thing, an F grade, you know, apartment complex, right?
Nice.
And it was F or D. You know, when I bought it, it was that way. Very old, you know, and it was just trashed. Every time someone would move out, it was just really trashed and it needed a ton of work. So you got to know, you know, in mobile homes, there's different size drywall. There's different flooring, you know, like it's not always plywood for the subfloor, right? It's that like particle board stuff that gets wet and then it swells up and then it gets soft. And now there's soft spots in the floors and just a ton of different things. The doors are different sizes. The windows are different sizes. So mobile homes can be complex to rehab and maintain. That's for sure. Well, Glenn, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for today, folks. Please leave a review if you got value out of the show. I appreciate you listening. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
Would you like to see Mobile Home Park value add projects in progress? If so, follow us on Instagram at @PassiveMHPInvesting for photos and awesome videos from our recent mobile home park acquisitions. Once again, that's @PassiveMHPInvesting on Instagram. See you there.